Come to order. We do have a quorum, so I need someone to make a motion to approve the minutes of Tuesday, March 31st. Representative Hillstrom makes that motion. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Members, I'm going to take a bill out of order here because I think it will be brief because we have a resolution to House File 1242. President Seifert, now did he just leave? Oh, he is. President Seifert, we have an amendment. Representative Smith, we have it in there.
Mr. Chairman, we currently have on the table D2 amendment, and I would have the amendment H1242A3 that I'd like to offer.
Okay, so we have the fiscal note, we have the bill 1242. The amendments are going out now. Okay. So we'll just wait a second here. Representative Seifert, Mr. Franklin, maybe the two of you could just come up and tell us what the amendment, or Representative Smith, do you want to tell us what the amendment does?
Mr. Chairman, I am prepared to walk you through it as quickly as I can. Looking at the DE2 amendment, the 2A3 amendment has some word changes and some deletions of paragraphs. Paragraph, for example, on line page 1, line 17. Excuse me. Well, let me refer back to the A3 amendment, just working down from the top. On page 2, line 3, we would be deleting the language, we would be inserting the language after the age of 21 to read, and at least one other factor in this paragraph is applicable. On page 3, line 32, we're deleting the word exact. Looking at page 4, there would be a deletion of everything beginning at line 4.4 to the end of that page, and then additional language deleted on page 5, lines 1 through 5.
Hang on one second, Representative.
Yes.
Is this lining up?
The A32 is amending the DE2. Is that what we're doing here?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Do we need a motion first to... we haven't moved either of these amendments. Why don't we do that, Representative Smith? It's early in the morning. It confused me. Why don't you make a motion to... Representative Smith will move the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Smith will move the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? I guess both and any votes. So now, Representative Smith, I'm sorry. I couldn't follow you. I was going off of the original bill, and now we're using the A3. And that is amending the DE2. So if you could just please start again, we can follow along.
Mr. Chairman, let me just generally summarize what the parties have agreed to. The author of the amendment and the Sheriff's Association have gotten together, and the A3 amendment is a result of their negotiation. Several words are being deleted. Some other words are being inserted. Whole paragraphs are being deleted, and I would point out one overriding part of the amendment is that the two provisions that are being deleted will be replaced with a working group that the David Francis and John Francis Foundation have agreed to fund. The working group will then develop a standardized form for all Minnesota law enforcement agencies to use when taking a missing persons report. Also develop standards on providing information to families on developments in a missing person case when no potential criminal investigation is involved. I think that's the gist of the amendment. Again, it reflects the discussions reached and agreed to between the author of the bill and the Minnesota State Sheriff's Association.
Very good. Questions at this point? Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, no, not a question, just a comment. Members should note that the fiscal note is now zero, and so I think we're in good shape. We have, as Representative Greg Davis likes to say, peace in the valley, I think.
Mr. Franklin, Representative Seifert, would you just come up for 1 minute and just let Mr. Franklin, are you satisfied? You worked this out with Representative Seifert, and I appreciate the work that both of you did together to try to reach a compromise when what seemed like it was going to be an intractable situation, but we'll work together and get things done. So are you satisfied now that this is not going to be cause a financial hardship to local law enforcement agencies?
Mr. Chairman and members, the agreement or the compromise we put together, I think, is in the best interest of all law enforcement. There will be some additional work that law enforcement will need to be doing on training. As I indicated to this group earlier, whenever you do a policy change, one of the key components is making sure that the training and people understand what we're doing. And we believe that this, when we get it all put together, will actually improve the system. Will it be some more work and some more training for the local units of government? The answer is yes. We're going to have to try to figure out how to absorb that in the downturn of our economy. We're not here to ask for funding to implement this, just simply because we understand the fiscal issues that are involved with the budget. But there is some retraining here that has to be done, but we're going to try to absorb that and just move on. And I think in the end, it will be a betterment to all of us in our system response.
Okay. Representative Seifert, do you have any quotes?
Mr. Chair, for Representative Seifert, I appreciate, and Mr. Franklin, thank you for working with Representative Seifert, and I appreciate that this is now in a better place for law enforcement. But Representative Seifert, I guess the question for you, I think I know the answer to it, but this is going to improve the situation for families who find themselves in this as well. I mean, we haven't eviscerated your bill. I think it still looks to me like it's going to improve the situation for families as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I talked with families that have involved. My staff has been in contact with them. They're excited that we were able to work out a compromise with law enforcement. I do want to publicly thank the Francis Foundation for putting up the money to do this. As Mr. Franklin pointed out, and I agreed in the last hearing, these things aren't free. And so these training brochures, et cetera, need to be paid for somewhere. The Francis Foundation has agreed. If you look at the Smith Amendment on the second page, it does say on 2.4 to be funded by private resources. The Francis Foundation, and I believe he is here, I would like to thank him publicly for putting the resources forward in our tough fiscal times. We are deleting some language. The families feel that we have a great bill here now. We can work on this in the interim. The working group will be funded by private resources. They may have suggestions for this committee in the next session, which is kind of a non-budget session. This language, the same concerns that were raised on the Senate side as in this committee, they will have this language sent over. They are going to meet deadline. They're meeting tomorrow on the same bill. So we do feel that we have peace in the valley, and I want to thank the members of this committee who gave me suggestions on how to get this put together. So I do want to thank everyone, Mr. Franklin, the Francis Foundation, et cetera, that this worked out very, very well. And the families are ecstatic that the committee members were so generous with their time.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seifert, Mr. Franklin, for your work on this. And then Representative Smith will renew his... Unless there's more discussion, Representative Smith will renew his motion that House File 1242 be passed and placed on a general register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now we'll go back to the bills in order. Representative Shostrom, 2063.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would assume you want the motion to be that House File 2063 be recommended to pass or be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety.
Would be the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kilstrom moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The public safety department has not had a performance measure report like the Department of Corrections. And so this bill would create one. And I have been working with the Department of Public Safety to take into account their requests, and that's what the A1 amendment is, Mr. Chair. And so I think we're in agreement. So, Mr. Chair, if the committee members have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But basically, it just gives some measures and targets that the department must put into their performance report.
Ms. Ellison, do you want to comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety. And yes, we would agree with these measures that are in this amendment.
And the treasurer shows me the fiscal note. There's no cost to this.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then. Any discussion? We will lay over House File 2063 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. Thank you, Ms. Ellison. Representative Hillstrom, you have another bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. I have House File 2065. I'd like it to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Mr. Chair, 2065 is regarding the Department of Corrections, and unfortunately I can't tell you that we have peace in the valley on this bill completely. The Department of Corrections has made some requests for some changes. However, one of them is the per diem that is within this committee's jurisdiction. It was Representative Hilty's bill. So I have not added that to this bill because as we are talking about how per diem should be reported in Representative Hilty's bill, I didn't want to put it in this bill. One, I don't agree with it, but two, I didn't want to put it in the bill if the committee doesn't adopt that. So that was one of their suggested changes. The second change that they had requested was on line 1.24, which is the recidivism analysis. And Mr. Chair, that is current law, and so I did not draft an amendment to change current law on how you should report on recidivism. I thought current law should stand. So the one change that I'd be happy to make that they requested, I didn't draft an amendment for it, but on line 2.7, the department has asked that rather than the report being due June 30th, that it be due August 31st, and I would be fine with that change, Mr. Chair.
So are you making that motion?
That would be an oral amendment, Mr. Chair, to state August 31st, deleting June 30th.
So Representative Hilstrom moves that on line 2.7, delete, strike June 30th, and insert August 31st. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Hilstrom, anything else?
Mr. Chair, just to say that this did come back with a zero fiscal note.
Does anyone from the Department of Corrections want to address the bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Chris Bray, Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Corrections. We thank you for the amendment to the change of dates. We're fine with leaving recidivism as it is currently defined. I think we'd still like to work out something on the per diems, but we will defer to Representative Hillstrom and the committee.
Okay. Any discussion or questions? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bray. Representative Hillstrom, we will lay over House File 2065 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hilton. Representative Eastland is not with us today. Representative Severson will be taking House File 1126.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move House File 1126 be passed and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Representative Severson, I think that the motion would be to lay it over unless you want this to go directly to the floor. I believe the motion was to include to have it possibly be included in the omnibus bill. Is that? I'll go either way. Whatever you want to do here.
Mr. Chair, laying it over would be appropriate, I believe.
Okay. Representative Severson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Unfortunately, Representative Eastland is not able to be with us this morning. He's asked me to step in, so don't be too brutal on me. But this bill has, it's a good move in terms of trying to approach some new innovative ways towards some sentence reform. It's got four major sections. The first is gives a little more discretion to the courts in terms of minimum mandatory sentencing, allows the prosecutor or the judge to make a motion to not go with the mandatory minimum sentencing, but have a consideration for a release or a conditional release on that, or a reduced sentence on that particular part. The second part is release procedures, and it establishes a three-judge panel, which is appointed by the Supreme Court to review the case for conditional release purposes. The third is an advisory board that addressed in Section 2, and then the fourth is a sunset provision that extends the sunset clause for the extended conditional release program that is scheduled to be sunset in 2009 and changes that to July 1st of 2011. And I'll let Mr. Knuth go into the more specifics of this, and then we will try and field any questions you may have.
Mr. Knuth, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Knuth. I represent the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Rob Eastland asked me to explain in a little more detail the bill, and I will also go into concerns that I've also heard about the bill. And I'm sure there are individuals here who may want to testify on some of the details as well. Representative Sewerson did an excellent job of explaining the bill. There are some concerns in Section 1 that deals with an automatic mandatory minimum for somebody who is found a repeat fifth degree controlled substance offender. Under current law, that's an automatic 6 months mandatory minimum, and the that's felt that is at least by a court of appeals opinion, which it should be in your packet. It looks like this. And the Court of Appeals indicated that there should be some flexibility in that automatic minimum. There was a case where a young woman had used controlled substances, had been drug-free for about 2.5 years, and found herself in a position of having the automatic mandatory minimum. The court passed the suggested to the legislature that this may not be necessary and should re-examine the approach. And the approach that's done here, it can either be recommended directly by the judge that's in Section 1, or the prosecutor can, for whatever reason, recommend it or not recommend it. So there's a decision point whether this can or cannot be done. The other point is dealing with the sunset provisions, and that's Section 4. The bill currently asks for an extension of the relief program to go on for an additional 2 years. In the Senate, that sunset was removed, so it would go on continuously until the legislature may change that. This early release program, as it's called, is a very difficult program to get in. It's very similar to challenge incarceration, and some of the criteria that you have to be serving a sentence for controlled substances. And the primary cause of being incarcerated is not for, if you've done it for profit, you will not be part of this program. You have to serve at least 36 months or half of your imprisonment. You must have completed treatment. You have no other previous conditional releases. That means that you can't, if you go back in, you can't repeat the program. And you have not been adjudicated or convicted of a crime during the last, or a violent crime during the previous years. There's a strong screening process. You must apply. You have to meet the mandatory criteria. There are some discretionary criteria. There's input taken from the prosecutor and the court because of sentencing, behavioral review, program review team, and the offender must sign off on a contract to be involved with this program, and the commissioner must have a review. Over the last, this program has been in since October of, from October 2005 till August 2008, there have been 70 inmates who have applied for this program. 20 self-terminated, one unfortunately died before entering the program. And in terms of the people who are involved in the program, 3 failed the program. 43 were set out on under the release program. One was terminated because they had some concerns, didn't make the requirements, and 3 were set had some problems and reconstructed their release program with the local community. Between 2005 and January of 2007, there was only about $218,000 that were avoided in cost, and that was a relatively small number. We don't have facts or figures on how much it would have actually gone through, but gone through the through 2008. So there are some savings in costs. One of the concerns that for the conditional release program, it's available to all prisoners, and it basically has the same requirements as challenge incarceration. Challenge incarceration is a very successful program along with this program. The challenge incarceration requires that somebody must be physically fit. They not have handicaps to be able to go through that program. And this allows another program for somebody who may have a handicap or some disability that wouldn't be allowed to go through the same type of program. There's some concerns by the Supreme Court on the 3-judge panel, and it's primarily, as my understanding, a fiscal concern. If the judges are appointed by the Supreme Court, then that would go to their budget. There may be ways of handling that, going through the department to make those appointments. Then it would be on the department's budget and would be taken by the savings. And there may be some others in terms of how the per diem or salary or those things can be modified. And then also modifying the length of time that this 3-judge panel is involved. There's considerable support for this report, considerable support for this bill. Judge Tom Neville from the 3rd Congressional District in Faribault, former senator, supports the bill. And he indicated that this is one of the only, one of the only sections of the only nearly unanimous support elements that was in the drugs control substance working group over the summer. It was for nearly unanimously. On March 28th, there was a editorial which is in your packet, which supports a supports the program. It's from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to quote one of my favorite authors, George Bernard Shaw. He says, take care of the pence and the pounds will take care of themselves. This program does not save vast sums of money, but it's really important to individuals who use it. And while we are saving a relatively small amount of money, this allows people to get out and to improve their lives and become productive tax-paying citizens again. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions of the author or the testifier, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. Mr. Knuth, do you know how many individuals have been sentenced in the last year or a couple years under this mandatory minimum requirement?
Mr. Knuth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I do not.
Representative Coles,
this is the case that I'm referring to is the one that you have in front of you from the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Knuth, as I look at Section 1, I don't necessarily have a big problem with it, except I think the language probably should be tightened up if we're going to go in this direction, to require that the court state on the record whatever the basis for moving on its own. It says that if the court finds substantial and compelling reasons, but if I'm a judge and I say I find substantial and compelling reasons and I'm going to ignore this mandatory minimum, that I think under a strict reading of the language is enough. The court doesn't have to state what those substantial and compelling reasons are, either in a written order or even on the record. I think that would hamstring the prosecutor's ability to appeal the court's decision in that regard. And if this is going to move forward, Mr. Chair, I'm not prepared to offer an amendment at this point in time, but I would have an amendment to require that those findings be made, that they be articulated by the court either in writing or at least on the record, so the prosecutor has some ability to challenge that that decision. Mr. Chair,
let me just see what. Gauge the temperature of that just so we can think about a possible amendment as this goes forward. Mr. Knuth?
Mr. Chairman, that seems... I don't mean to put words into Representative Eastland's mouth, but it does not seem unreasonable. It seems reasonable to me because there should be a record in case there is an opportunity for appeal.
Okay, Representative Corker.
Mr. Chair, with regard to... Section 2 and 3 of the bill. I'm curious. I don't see a fiscal note. I'm curious if what the costs are going to be for creating this board. And
we don't have one completed at this point, but hopefully we will. Soon.
Mr. Chair, I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with Section 2 and 3 here. I don't know that we should create a board to second-guess the decisions of the Department of Corrections. I haven't heard anything compelling that they're not doing this appropriately. Now, maybe they're fine with this, but I'm not sure that that it makes some sense, especially if it's a cost. I know retired judges like to stay busy, but they also like to be paid, so I suspect there's probably going to be some costs associated with this.
Well, hopefully we'll get the fiscal note, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, I actually have been told, at least in my office, if not in public, that the Department of Corrections does not like to do this, and unless we make them, they're not going to. So if we want folks to do this, we're going to have to find a way to put it in statute to make them do this. I just found, again, we've talked a lot about the Challenge Incarceration Program. Just found out that the standards for early release were actually easier than the standards for the challenge incarceration. So folks were being denied challenge incarceration and then were being permitted to go out on this early release program. So I think we're going to probably have to put it in statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I appreciate that. I'm not sure that I'm not sold on the efficacy of early release to start with. I know some members around here are, and I appreciate that. I'm not one of them. So I appreciate your comments, but there's going to be some cost with this. So we already have budget challenges. I'm not sure we want to add to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I'm looking at this, I think this is a really good idea. This whole bill, and I think it's moving in the right direction, but I want to address a couple things that Representative Coles has brought up. First of all, on the first section of the bill, I really think we should think really hard before we add more burdens to the court in terms of stating or writing what their reasons are and creating reasons for appeal and so on. Now, I may be totally wrong, and it's too bad that Representative Eastland isn't here to sort of describe his thinking, but it seems to me that what we're trying to do here is kind of do a little bit of an end run around the minimum mandatory, because we realize that it really doesn't make a lot of sense a lot of the time. And so as I see it, part of this is an intention to, you know, the fiscal realities are behind this too. So we want to make sure that people who appropriately could be avoiding the mandatory minimum sentence are able to do that. And if we then add a lot of burdens on the other side, that it's got to be justified and we're creating opportunities for appeal and so on, I think we're going to have fewer people that are going to be able to take advantage of this. We're giving the court discretion with one hand and taking it away with the other. I think we kind of have to make up our mind here and take a little bit of heat if we want to be able to actually make a change and use the money for something else. So that would be my first thought is this, you know, this cuts kind of a nice balance there, and I would leave it as it is and not add any additional language to it.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. And I'll just take a stab at this. I think there are some extenuating circumstances, obviously, that come up with the individual cases. With the mandatory sentencing, minimum mandatory sentencing we have for repeat offenders here, it really ties the judge's hands in order to take into consider extenuating circumstances. I think one of the cases that Mr. Knuth was speaking of previously was a woman who had been clean for 2 years, got caught with a minimum amount of drugs on her person, required at least a six-month sentence. Well, that six-month sentence, the way we currently have it, is going to be spent in the county jail. And so that becomes a cost to the county. And that is that really going to do much for this young lady? So I think in terms of what Representative Coles was talking about, a minimum statement that basically puts in the circumstances surrounding that particular mitigation would be an appropriate thing. I don't think it would be onerous to the prosecutor or to the judicial system per se. So I would, that's kind of how I see that particular provision.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, when it says the court, if the court finds substantial and compelling reasons, I mean, the court is going to have to say, I find substantial and compelling reasons. I think what we're discussing here is whether the court has to go on and state more specifically what those reasons are so as to give prosecutors an opportunity to appeal. You have another problem where you're not stating any standards, you know, what would be substantial and compelling. How are you going to measure that on appeal anyway? I'm just saying you're adding a can of worms here that personally I don't think is necessary. And I just wouldn't change this. So anyway, let me go on to the other part that I wanted to discuss, which is this advisory board thing. I don't have a real clear sense here of how that would be expected to work. What I think is the bill is trying to do is sort of make another layer to make sure that if somebody's being denied, that it's for a really good reason. And I'm not sure that this, the way this is set up, would do that. And I'm just not sure that what this particular form is really going to accomplish. And I share Representative Hillstrom's concerns that we might be just kind of adding a layer without really accomplishing the goal of making sure that people who really should be in this program get a chance to be there. So maybe we could have a little more discussion of that. I mean, I'm not sure at what point the commissioner has to consult with this board. The commissioner consult, and as I read the bill, the board could say, oh, we absolutely think this person should be in the program, and that doesn't do anything for the person anyway, because the commissioner can just say, well, I don't, and that's the end of it. So I don't really, that's why I don't see what we're accomplishing. I hope you understand my concern and can address it.
Representative, Mr. Knuth.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think it's probably one of these, the purpose of this is, as simply as stated, is the commissioner would have an advisory group, learned in law, to review the facts, review what's involved with an early release, and to simply make a recommendation. And it obviously is up to the commissioner, according to the bill and current law, to make that final decision. But it would create somewhat of a buffer between, at least an advisory buffer for the commissioner to look to and to take a step back and to have a group look at it who are learned in the law, as I said, and to advise her. It would create a neutral place to get information from to the commissioner and from for the commissioner to make a decision.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to go on with this too long, but I think we're just creating an extra jump here, hurdles to go over that doesn't really have much meaning then, because, you know, I'm sure the commissioner has people she can talk to. You know, she's got lawyers in her department and so on, you know, unless we say that, you know, she's got to listen to them in some way, or, you know, if they all say yes and the commissioner says no, that they prevail or something like that, I don't really see the point. I mean, I see the desire to get more people into the program and make sure that those denials are appropriate denials, but I frankly don't think this gets us here.
We have a couple of people who want to testify on this bill, so maybe we should do that now. Is there someone from the department that's...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Crist. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections opposes the repeal of the sunset. We prefer that these candidates for programming in the department participate in the challenge incarceration program. As pardon me, as we showed during one of our budget presentations, we think there are very few low-risk or nonviolent offenders in our department. Minnesota is the second lowest per capita incarceration. We incarcerate a very distilled group of offenders. We're the sixth highest use of probation intermediary sanctions. So we try to keep people out of prison except for those that really need to be there. Many of the offenders in a potential candidate pool do not qualify because of their current or prior offenses and histories of violence. Briefly, Mr. Chairman, for those reasons, we oppose expansion of this program and prefer to use the Challenge Incarceration Program, which has been successful over its 16-year life in reducing recidivism. With respect to the a contract or the judges, the department would not be in agreement with any proposal that caused the cost of that to come out of our budget. And further, I want to mention to the committee that when the conditional release program was started a couple of years ago, it funded three ISR agent positions. And if the program is extended, we would hope that the committee would extend funding for those three ISR agents as well. Then finally, with respect to the judges panel, in section 2, the language indicates that the commissioner shall consider whether the offender was involved in criminal gang activity during the incarceration term, his custody status, level of violence, and availability of appropriate community supervision. We would submit that we can do those things at the front end of the program rather than at the release point, and it would be much fairer to the offender if we told them up front, we're not going to let you in the program because we don't think you're appropriate for release, rather than make them go through the entire program and then tell them at the end, we looked back and even though you've completed the program, we don't think you're appropriate for release. So if this were to be adopted, we would suggest that the consultation with the commissioner happen on the front end of admission to the program as opposed to after the offender has completed the program and dash any hopes he might have of early release at that point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Crist. Any questions, Mr. Olin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment, or a quick question. Mr. Chris, I tend to agree with you. I don't know that we need this other program, but what I do want to know is, are we going to have a commit? If we don't put in this other clauses, are we going to have a commitment to actually fill this challenge incarceration program that presently isn't filled?
Assistant Commissioner Chris.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Owen, fair question. We've worked very hard at expanding those criteria. I can't guarantee that we will get to 162 men in that program, but I think that we can get close, and we understand the will of the committee that we do fill that program.
Anyone else? Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Chris, for your testimony. David Brown.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. With regard to sections 2 and 3 of the bill, the expansion of the conditional release program, the Hennepin County attorney was part of the working group on controlled substances, and there was general agreement towards expanding these early release programs. The one that was focused on in that working group was this conditional release program. I will tell you that the proposal in the bill you have here has been significantly altered from what that working group recommended. There was no discussion about a three-judge panel, and frankly, I don't know how that all is going to work, who's going to pay for it, what kind of review, is it something mandatory? That's something that's been changed since the working group did it. They were talking about validated risk assessments at the front end, getting chemical dependency treatment. I can tell you the general goals were that four repeat drug and nonviolent offenders, to the extent that they could complete treatment in prison and thereby reduce the risk to public safety by being released, consistent with public safety, there was general agreement to try and get them out once they had done that. The details of this one, this proposal, were not something they agreed to. And the other thing you should know is there was some fairly strong opinion towards splitting the savings. If we're going to release people back out into local facilities or local areas, taking some of the savings we would realize from that and dividing it between the state correctional authority, giving them more money for both treatment and supervision, and also the local correctional authority. That was an important piece from our community members. As to Section 1, that is something that the County Attorneys Association, Hennepin County Attorney, has opposed. And let me tell you a little bit about why. The removal of the 6 month mandatory minimum, these are repeat low level drug offenders. But the repeat is crucial. In the metro area, particularly Hennepin County, understand that the first time somebody does one of these crimes, they're getting diversion. In Hennepin County, frequently, the second time they do something like this, they're getting a stay of adjudication under Minnesota Statute 15218. So by the time we're dealing with the 6 month mandatory minimum, at least in Hennepin County, we're often talking about a third time offense. And I will tell you at that working group, much of the opposition to removing this 6 month mandatory minimum actually came from the community members who are seeing these people get back out and back out and back out into their communities where they're causing problems. Now, the way the judges in Hennepin County handled the 6 month mandatory minimum is not to send them to the workhouse for 6 months. It is to impose the 6 month penalty and then furlough them. What that does, by doing it in that mechanism, it actually gives the judge a little more control over them. We run a drug court in Hennepin County. And it gives them the ability, if the person tests positive for drugs or is out causing problems in the community, they can pull them back into the workhouse without having to go through some of the additional procedural mechanisms. So there's actually a very practical reason. You say, well, what about rural Minnesota? It was actually greater Minnesota representatives on this work group that said, if we have repeat offenders in our communities, we want them going for this mandatory minimum. So it gave some discretion, and I understand that there are provisions here that allow the judge to waive that. It's not something that the working group adopted. In fact, they voted it down. And it is something that we oppose.
Question for Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Davidson, you know, there's still some questions about the bill. So I would just, before, let me just say that, you know, I would think the best thing to do was, you know, your motion was to lay the bill over, and we should do that. And hopefully between now and the time that we vote on the bill, some of these issues can be worked out.
Mr. Chair, that was going to be my suggestion, that we possibly lay it on the table, allow the original author to listen to the tapes, present some of the responses to some of the arguments that have been raised here, and then get with you afterwards to determine whether we want to pull it off the table and vote on it or leave it on the table.
Okay. Well, we would either put it in the bill or not, would be probably, or amend it.
Right.
Any further questions? Okay, Representative Stevenson, thank you for presenting the bill for Representative Eastland, and the Chair will lay over House File 1126 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
And Representative Smith, House File 1611. Representative Smith, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. House File 1611 has to do with amending existing statute regarding interest amount payable upon a judgment if the amount is not paid immediately pending an appeal. And I brought with me one testifier, Mr. Joel Carlson, and I'll ask him to explain and or answer any questions.
Representative Smith, would you just please move the bill first?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd move the bill.
Thank you.
I'll file 1611.
Okay, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and appreciate your consideration again of this provision. Minnesota has one of the lowest post-judgment interest rates in the country. All of our surrounding states have a higher post-judgment interest rate, which we believe is more fair to those that are owed money judgments. We also believe that there is a potential savings to the court on the number of appeals that are being taken to the Court of Appeals that we believe could be resolved if our judgment interest rate was higher. We don't see a number of these kinds of appeals from our members that practice in Minnesota and Wisconsin, for example, which has an interest rate of 12%. Because they simply pay the judgment, and there's no benefit in delaying payment on the judgment. So, in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman and members, we've worked with the court and legal aid on this issue to resolve any concerns that they have, and we'd appreciate your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We have a couple of questions, Reverend Cole.
Chair, I'm not sure if this is a question for you or for Representative Smith or Mr. Carlson, but what's this bill doing here?
Well, we were just talking about where it should go, if it should go to the general register or belong to the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, this is a civil justice policy issue. I'm not sure. It doesn't look as though Representative Mallory's committee has heard it. Representative Smith, what's the status of this bill in the Senate?
Representative Smith.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Bentzel has introduced the bill in the Senate, and just by way of background, this bill does affect the courts. It was in the omnibus public safety bill in 2007. It's been heard in this committee and approved by this committee and passed the House in that omnibus bill with, I think, a vote of 96 votes.
Mr. Chair, that's a great history lesson, but we have committee deadlines that don't appear to have been met. Senator Bethel may have introduced the bill there. This clearly is a policy issue. Maybe it ultimately ends up in your bill, but I'm not sure that the bill's met deadline, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that it belongs in this committee. We've got policy issues here, and I think there's probably some people who want to testify in opposition to the bill, but I'm not sure that this is the right direction to go, but I'm also not sure that we're following the rules, Mr. Chair, and I know you know that I'm a big stickler for the rules.
Representative Reiner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, or Mr. Carlson, why 10%? Why not 9? Why not 11? What are our neighboring states doing?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, our current floor at 4% is the lowest in the country, and an average rate appears to be about 10%. 7 states have 12, 11 states have 10, 4 states have 9, so we picked an average among the states.
Mr. Chair, brief follow-up.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say average, that was a national average or average of our border states? Or?
Mr. Chairman and members, several states have a rate that is higher than Minnesota's but is tied to some particular index like our current rate is right now. So of those states, I didn't go in and do the research on those states, what their particular rate is right now. Of the states that have a stated rate, 10% would be the average of those states.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, I guess that would be just a follow-up on that. Why wouldn't we go with an index like Prime Plus so that you wouldn't have to be back here changing based on the fluctuational rates?
Mr. Carl.
Mr. Chairman and members, that is what we have right now, and it is tied to a yield that produces such a low result that what we're asking for is in those judgments that are in excess of $50,000 that the floor be raised. The problem with our current system right now is the formula that we use produces a rate that at its zenith, I believe, was around 7%. And that just doesn't reflect what the cost to the business or the consumer that is owed a money judgment for holding that money. It just doesn't reflect what that cost really is. Our current rate right now is 4%, and the index, I think, produces something less than 4%. And so it doesn't work the way we've had it right now. Most states have, the states that we've looked at, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, we tried that with the court, and to have the courts redo a formula cost them money to do that. It is much more effective and easier to accomplish it through just having a stated rate. We did look at a different formula, and it didn't work.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my point is because the bill suggests that the problem is because the market rate, someone's delaying and appealing because they can get better market rates in some other investment. So if you tied it to the market rates themselves, we wouldn't have to go back here 2 years or 3 years. You can add whatever, I'd assume, however many points you want to that formula to make it the incentive still there to pay.
Other questions? Representative Weidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly asked half of my question, which is great, but the other half is, Mr. Carlson, could you just expound a little bit more on the impact on the courts? You kind of alluded to that. Some of us, because we may not do civil, we don't understand where the money goes. We don't necessarily understand what is in this judgment that the interest is being paid on.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Levin. We don't think there is a financial cost to the court because we're not asking them to create a new formula. The judgment interest rate is set by them every year on January 1st, and so we don't think this produces any additional cost to them. The amount that's owed is generally calculated by the parties and not by the court.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Carlson, I guess I just wanted you to make clear that the money we're talking about, all of this goes to the plaintiff, right? This is not any, the money doesn't flow into the court in any way. Am I right?
Correct.
Any other questions? Representative Smith, I'll let you decide where you want to move this.
Mr. Chairman, I'll throw the ball back. My preference would be, after moving the bill, would be that the chair would lay it over for possible inclusion. However, if the chair wants to amend my motion to move it to finance and then the general register, that's up to you and the committee.
Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to testify about the bill? Please come up.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesotans against lawsuit abuse and opposition to House File 1611. I know, Mr. Chairman, the time is limited here, and I think at a policy committee we could bring to the committee the 50-state chart to have you see what the other states do on interest on judgment. And while Mr. Carlson gave some brief summary statistics, there's a lot more detail that would be relevant to the debate about whether Minnesota should change the current interest on judgment statute. We think the answer is no. The MALA Coalition represents a large number of statewide business groups, and we believe the current rate provided for in 549.09 is fair, it's reasonable, it's pegged to the interest rate environment, which does change. If the interest rate environment changes, which it surely will, then Minnesota law provides for an increase accordingly. From the MALA's perspective, we think these are not the economic times to be increasing the cost within the civil justice system, which we believe House File 1611 will do. These judgments is across the board, I think, as everybody knows, is liability judgments, auto insurance judgments, property insurance judgments. Are there other states that have higher rates? Yes. They vary. And there's gradations in those state statutes. They're not just, in some cases they're fixed numbers, some there's discretion with the judges and within the system and when the higher rates apply. Mr. Chairman, MALA Coalition and the members of it oppose increasing the interest rate at this time and would urge your no vote on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this would be for Mr. Carlson again. I guess I kind of want to return to my previous question. I think you had said something about, whether having a higher interest rate encourages people to pay up and kind of, that was sort of the impact on the court that I was asking about. In what way does raising interest rates get the case done and out of the court so that the court can deal with the next thing? Could you go into that just a bit?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and President Liebling, anecdotally, I can tell you that we have practitioners that practice both in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, and routinely they believe that appeals are taken on Minnesota judgments simply because we have a lower interest rate, and that those appeals do cost money and they take time. And it is not inconceivable that you can buy down the value of what you owe by making more money in the market than what you owe in interest to the judgment creditor. And so we believe that there will be potentially a reduction in the number of appeals that that may not have merit. And we have interest rates that are higher. The interest rate on no-fault auto, which is the impact on insurance that we just heard about, is 15%. So this just brings us more in line and is more consistent with not only other states, but with what we believe the actual cost of holding that judgment is for the creditor. And it's not just consumers, it's businesses, it is other judgments as well. And we don't believe this has any impact. These are all, this is not anything to do with frivolous cases. And I would remind the committee that civil cases in Minnesota are down over 40% in the last 10 years. This has nothing to do with frivolous cases. I already have obtained a judgment from the bench or jury in these particular instances.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up briefly and make a comment. You know, having Mr. Johnson come and testify on this kind of brought this to my mind, because we've got a number of bills going through about insurance industry and kind of stonewalling and making people who really should be getting their claims satisfied, making them wait and so on, and kind of how are the incentives aligned. And it just occurs to me that that's kind of what we're talking about here, and it does have this impact, I think, on the courts, although it's a little hard to quantify and it's a little less direct. You know, to the extent that we're giving people the proper incentives to settle claims that should be settled, pay things that you owe, and then get out of court and let somebody else have the space for what should be a real serious dispute where there are really issues in dispute. But that's a good thing for us to do for the whole court system. Thank you.
Any other questions? Anything else, Deputy Minister?
Mr. Chairman, no.
The Chair will lay over House File 1611 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Finance Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr.
Smith. Final bill, if Representative Olin would do the honors of...
Representative Paymar, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1827. My motion would be to have the committee lay this over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Okay. Do you have any testifiers with you?
Let me just briefly explain the bill, and then I'd ask Mr. Saul to go into more detail. House File 1827 was brought to this committee by the Judicial Branch. As you know, they've talked to us in the past about the importance of automating the system in the court and having more effective ways of collecting debt. I don't have to tell this committee of the financial problems the court has, we believe that there's the sections of this bill address some of those problems. Most of the bill, if you look through it, is a lot of cleanup language for the court. What the automation and collection components of this bill does, it will bring more money to the state of Minnesota, and it will also bring more money to local units of government. I just draw your attention to a couple sections of the bill that you might look at. This bill was heard in policy, so I won't go into detail about each section, but in section 19 proposes a unified distribution process that sets out how fine money is paid to municipalities and to the state when the case is prosecuted on behalf of municipalities. And then in section 25 of the bill speaks to the fine and surcharge collection, and it establishes the authority for the court to refer unpaid fines to collection agency. As I believe Ms. Dussal testified to this committee a while back, there's about $160 million in unclaimed or settled fines that certainly would help the bottom line, and this bill would make that easier to collect that money. And then finally on section 27, it establishes that a conviction for a misdemeanor that was treated as a petty misdemeanor by inclusion on the payable list may not be used as an enhancement to a gross misdemeanor on a subsequent violation. And section 28 deals with the gives the Judicial Council the authority to establish a uniform fine schedule, and this is the payables list. And I want just to ensure the committee, and one of the reasons I agreed to carry the bill, although I have some problems with the payable list, that I do think that the exclusions for domestic violence offenses and orders for protection and some of the minor sex offenses, having them excluded from the payables list provides me with some assurances that we're not jeopardizing public safety. With that, I would turn it over to Ms. Dussal, and she's got one of the comments, and then she can answer your questions.
Mr. Dussal, you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, maybe I would just say, talk about the purposes of the bill and then stand for questions. Three main purposes of the bill. The first is an efficiency measure. We've talked before in this committee about the importance of trying to take advantage of the state's investment in our significant technology program, a MNCIS program. This bill would make possible the our efforts to centralize and to automate 1.2 million payable citations of the 2 million cases that the courts handle each year. So this would help us to reduce some of our labor costs. In order to do so, though, we need clarification from the legislature on the very complicated and maze of fines and fees splits among state and local government. The second thing it does is provide enhanced enforcement of judicial sanctions. As Representative Paymar indicated, we have millions of dollars of unpaid debt on our books, and this represents thousands of violators who have failed to appear or to pay their fines. Unfortunately, as you well know, the justice system does not have the resources today and certainly will not have it in the next biennium and beyond to individually monitor all of these unpaid fines and then to take action on them. The scarce law enforcement resources we now have in the state, we just do not have the ability to issue arrest warrants and have the scarce resources, law enforcement resources, go out and pick up violators and bring them in and book them and bring them into court for a $200 fine. And as a result, it just is not happening. What we're looking for is a mechanism, another tool to the package of this bill allows us to automate these matters, make them more systematic and consistent in terms of reviewing them, and then sending them off to collection so that there is a much higher possibility of imposing and actually receiving a sanction from these violators. And finally, as Representative Paymar has indicated, this will result in significant new revenue to state and local government and to crime victims. In this coming biennium, we're estimating approximately $21.7 million in this next biennium, about $6.3 million for crime victims, and the remainder going to state and local government and to other various accounts with which these monies get distributed. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carger, is there a fiscal note for this bill? I don't see it in my packet, or maybe I missed it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole, no, we do not have a formal fiscal note. There is a page in the packet, though, that I think will summarize the impact, the financial impact.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Carger. Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, just one question. I'm comfortable with the bill. I like the bill. I think we should try to accommodate the court's request here. With regard to the payable list, I'm maybe not all the way there yet, but I'm very much warming to Representative Emmer's proposal, and I don't know what you intend to do with that, but one of the things that we heard testimony about is that on a first-time DUI, it could be treated as a petty, but the intent, as I understood it from Representative Emmer, and certainly my preference would be that if we are going to treat a first-time DWI as a petty, that it would, in fact, be enhanceable, and Section 28 would seem to not provide that. I'm just hoping, Representative Paymar, that if we do decide to move forward with Representative Emmer's bill, that you'll work with me or with others to make sure that if we treat a DWI offense as a petty, if it becomes a payable, that in fact a subsequent DWI is enhanceable, as I think Representative Emmer said his intent was with that proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Paymar.
Representative Paul, I agree, and I think that we need probably more discussion on Representative Emmer's bill. I don't know where if it's going to progress to here or not. Maybe get some information for us, but I think that's a good point. We would need to discuss that. I would not like to see a DWI be on the payable list, quite frankly, but you know, that may come down the line. And what we do on enhancement, I think you're quite right. If it ended up on the payable list, we'd have to modify this provision. I believe there's an amendment, Mr. Chair, that Representative Lesch has to offer, that there was some issues with the city attorneys, and I think we have a resolution to that.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one amendment. First of all, the courts did come with recommendations. As you recall, as some members may recall, in the last committee where this came through, there was some deal cutting with respect to the decision about the payables list. And before I explain the amendment, members, let me say that this was a very difficult process for me and for many prosecutors, I think, with the decision about the different branches of government, the executive branch, which prosecutes, the judicial branch, which resolves the disputes, or that's the idea, that it's to resolve the disputes, and this branch, which has oversight. Now, we decide the level of offenses based on how we set them for the penalties here. If you have over a year in jail, that's a felony of how we set it in the legislature. If it's up to a year, it's a gross misdemeanor. Up to 90 days, it's a misdemeanor. If it's maximum $300, it's a petty. And the courts, by virtue of their sentence vis-a-vis those laws, thereby create the level of the offense. That said, when we create the level of offense here, it's the legislative intent that we have some uniform application of the law. So in light of that, there was a lot of discussion surrounding the move in the direction of the payables list, and prosecutors had substantial issues with the courts moving towards decriminalizing with the additional understanding that the courts were not going to be able to do what we thought they should do with the limitations on funding that they had. So that was the history of the amendment and out of the deal that was worked out. Now, in the wake of that, there was some concerns that the courts had with language. The first portion of the amendment for the agreement would be, Mr. Chair, on lines 20.21, removing the last three words of that line, for disposition purposes. The reason for that amendment is it has impact on the court's expected results for what they can impose as petty misdemeanors. The city attorneys had issues with respect to how that would impact police procedures for the rights of arrest and various under attendant criminal procedure actions, but we're taking that out because we believe that the sentence on starting on 2.25 gives adequate protections for peace officers to make arrests despite the fact that misdemeanors now become petty misdemeanors.
Representative Lesch, may I ask a quick question before you proceed too far? Is this going to be an all-oral amendment? How many parts to it are there?
There are two parts, Mr. Chair. The first part, I just stated those three words.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's the agreement from the courts. The other oral amendment is technical.
Okay. Let's have the other oral amendment first, and let's take the technical one first.
The other oral amendment would be on lines 2.27, and some gnomes over in Senate Council overnight came up with this, I guess. Prior to the word this, insert, this subdivision is effective July 1st, 2009, and applies to acts committed on or after that date.
Did you say 20.27 or 2.27?
20.27.
Oh, yeah. That's. Would you repeat that again now that we're on the right page?
Yes. Prior to the word this, okay. Insert, this subdivision is effective July 1st, 2009, and applies to acts committed on or after that date, period.
Okay. Can counsel please repeat that to make sure we all know what we're on?
Mr. Chair, members, just a technical amendment?
Yes, just a technical. Let's do it separately.
Okay, on page 20, line 27, before this, insert, this subdivision is effective July 1st, 2009, and applies to acts committed on or after that date.
Representative Paymar, do you have any comments on that? I know Coles, but I just wanted to know.
Fine.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I have any problems with it, but it says on line 20.31 the same exact thing. So I'm not sure. Is this belt, suspenders, and garters?
Yeah, it does say the same.
I think probably also a navel ring. Coles, yeah, enable. All that.
Okay. Now I might be opposed if we're talking about piercings, but...
Is there any other discussion to that amendment? Seeing no other discussion, all those in favor, Representative Lesher's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed.
Mr. Chair,
amendment carried.
May I speak to some other provisions that the court said require?
Well, let's do the other amendment now if you want.
Oh, we did that. Okay.
Thank you. I did them separate.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 20, line 21, delete for disposition purposes.
Representative Lesh moves to delete for disposition purposes on line 20.21, the last three words. Is there any discussion on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment carried. Go ahead, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for members' clarification, the courts had also requested, in the wake of that deal, which happened kind of quickly, in the last committee, they had asked for a couple other amendments. They noted that the insert of the sunset throws the bill off balance. I noted that. I also note that the problems in order to fix that will again come before this same committee in 2 years, and I believe that's appropriate and that we're responsible for the cleanup of that. Second, also, they wanted the courts wanted language that would be similar or akin to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission language, whereby the tables list is effective unless objected to by the legislature, thereby preserving the legislative oversight role. I had substantial concerns with that, members, because I think we're doing something very different here than we do with just approval of sentencing guidelines. This, I think, implicates the separation of powers in the state of Minnesota very much by this being changed for the courts and them modifying our offense levels. That said, I think it's something we probably need to do because of the funding crisis. And I think this is what this does. The change for the payables list is a wink and a nod for the purposes of the period of the sunset. I also would note this, though. The court's concern are concerns that when they come forward and have to have the legislature affirmatively approve this payables list, that we're going to nitpick these individual fees with respect to whatever fines you may have, and you got a constituent that has a concern with how much he has to pay because he had too many fish in his boat or something. I have told the courts that I absolutely think that's out of line for us to do that we should not be nitpicking their payables list without causing them too much hassle. And I think there probably would be a plurality, if not a majority, of individuals on this committee in subsequent sessions where we approve this as well. However, I just think it's important to preserve that function, and so that's why I wanted that language to stay in.
Are there any other questions from this body? Are there any witnesses or testifiers in the audience wishing to comment on this bill? If not, the chair will lay over as amended file number 1827. And before anybody retreats, there is a couple announcements that Chair Paymar will handle.
Just wanted to announce to the committee that it is our intent to have the omnibus bill completed this weekend, and I have spoken to President Coles, who's the lead Republican on the committee, and that we will have it to him Monday morning, which will give the GOP side ample opportunity to meet the committee rules and get any amendments that you might have to the bill within the 24-hour rule. And it is our intent to take testimony and have discussion on the omnibus bill Tuesday at 6, Tuesday evening, 6:30, and vote on the bill. So that's it. Any questions on that? Anything else before the committee? Thank you, members. This meeting is adjourned.